Hey, good evening, everybody. First of all, I want to apologize for the video not working again. I had to be at the office tonight late for a program. We were giving a special award to the CEO of the year for the Dallas area, and it was Mark Cuban, and I wanted to go drink a few free beers on Mark Cuban's dime and meet him. Unfortunately, he couldn't show up. I guess there's an NBA strike or something going on. So anyway, I had to be at the office, and the office computer doesn't seem to like the video for some reason. I don't know why. So we're going to have to go without video. You know, tonight's talk is our last talk of this sort of five-lecture series, and in some ways it's not a very good fit for the previous, four. The other lectures were all about the Economic Freedom of the World Index in one degree or another. The EFW Index, the first lecture was about the EFW Index itself. The second one was about EFW and growth, and then we talked about some special topics like the economic freedom and human rights and economic freedom and democracy. Today's a little bit off the beaten path in some ways, but it's not really about economic freedom as such, but it is also about part of the theme for this little mini course, and that is that I really do think that when we have debates with each other and with others, when classical liberals have debates with each other, but more importantly, when classical liberals have debates with non-liberals, with socialists or whatever you want to call them, how important it is not just to argue theoretically, but how important it is to, wherever possible at least, to bring data and evidence to the table. And so one area that I have become interested in the last few years is in the ability of people to move freely from one country to another. In some sense, this is about economic freedom. It's about the freedom of travel. And I started to become interested in this in part because I was a frequent traveler myself. I would go around the world, and one of the things that any frequent traveler notices is the travel visa regime that exists around the world is really an impediment to travel. You might think it's not a big deal. If you haven't traveled a lot around the world, maybe you don't think it's a big deal. But, for very many people who travel a lot, dealing with visas, whether you're simple tourist travel visas or work visas, is really a big deal for a lot of people. And to me, as a classical liberal, someone who thinks about freedom and also has a sort of data and empirical orientation, I got interested in the idea of trying to measure the severity or the extent to which people were free to travel. So freedom of travel is quite multidimensional in its own right. I mean, you could think about the freedom to travel for a simple vacation. So, you and your family, you want to go to Cancun, or you want to go to Rio de Janeiro, or you want to go to Rome, or you want to go to see the Taj Mahal. So there's tourist visas, there's tourist travel. And then there's travel of a more intermediate nature. So if you're a business person and you want to go to a foreign country to negotiate a contract, but you might have to stay there for 2 or 3 months to negotiate the deal. That's another type of travel. And then, of course, in the far limit, the most extreme type of travel would be, immigration or immigration itself. I mean, moving from country A to country B for the purpose of working there and maybe in the end, even becoming a citizen there, outright immigration. So there are degrees of travel freedom, from simply letting tourists travel from one country to another, to letting business people travel for business purposes, to letting workers travel from one country to another for worker purposes, and then in the limit, of course, there's immigration. So I got interested in this a few years ago, and I thought that one of the things, if you look at the academic literature on travel and tourism and business travel and even immigration, there really isn't a lot of data out there. So I set out with the first project, and this is the very, very first project in what I hope is going to be a multi-paper, a multi-year, a long-term project for me over the next 10 or 15 years of my career. I hope that I can make a second name for myself. I mean, the first name, I suppose, has to be the Economic Freedom Index, but the second name I hope to make for myself is as being someone who is an expert in understanding the impediments to travel and mobility, human mobility around the world. So anyway, that brings us to this paper. This is actually a paper that is published. It's been accepted in the journal Public Choice, and it's co-authored with Jamie Lemke. Jamie is a student of mine from Capital University when I was a professor there. This has been some years ago. And Jamie went to work for the Koch Foundation and then decided to go get her PhD at George Mason University. So right now, Jamie is a fourth-year graduate student at George Mason University. She's writing her dissertation under, I think she's writing under Pete Leeson or Peter Becky, I'm not really sure which. But they're both going to be on our committee, so she's doing a lot of really interesting work. She's doing some interesting work on her dissertation related to female property rights, the evolution of property rights for females. She has a really, really cool and interesting paper with Pete Leeson on wife sales, which is a bizarre kind of concept. In any case, I was interested in this working on travel visas paper, and I went to a graduate student of mine, and I asked my graduate student if she would start looking at travel visas. And my grad student started to look at it, and she came to me and said, "This is too much work. We can't do this. This is crazy. I quit." So I wasn't deterred, so I went to Jamie and said, "Well, I had a graduate student who decided this was too much work. What do you think?" And she said, "Well, I can do it." So Jamie and I started working on travel visas. So let me talk about the project itself. So this is a project which is primarily, at this stage of the game, a data collection project. We've collected a lot of data. I'm not really sure where it's going to take us yet. But one of the things that what we were interested in here is how easy is it to travel from one country to another without a travel visa. And if you haven't traveled around the world, we're talking here about simple tourist class visas, the 30-day visa that you might get if you wanted to see the Taj Mahal or go to Cancun for vacation. We wanted to try to measure this in some way, and so anyway, that's what led to this particular paper. So let me move on and talk about the project itself more. Before I do that, I want to mention drop a couple quotes because, you know, I'm not the first person to be interested in this, and I'm not a fan of Keynes or Keynesian economics, and I suspect most of you are not as well. But Keynes did write one really wonderful book, in my opinion, and that was The Economic Consequences of the Peace, written after World War I. And in that book, at the very beginning of the book, Keynes talks about what he called that extraordinary time before 1914, before World War I. There was an extraordinary time during which a person could secure forthwith, if he wished it, cheap and comfortable means of transit to any country or climate without passport or other formality, and would consider himself greatly aggrieved and much surprised at the least interference. But most of all, he regarded this state of affairs as normal, certain, and permanent, and any deviation from it as aberrant, scandalous, and avoidable. In Keynes, in the Economic Consequences of the Peace, written in 1920, Keynes was lamenting the lost era of open human mobility. At least in Europe, it was the case that an English citizen could travel throughout Europe, all the way to Moscow, Italy, Istanbul, Berlin, Madrid, anywhere you wanted to go, throughout Europe at least. You could travel from place to place, as long as you could afford the transit, the train fare. You could travel from place to place, and there was never a border check, ever, crossing from Spain to France, France to Germany, Germany to Poland, Poland to Russia, anywhere you wanted to go. There were no border checks whatsoever. There were no passports or formalities, and it was, and that people in the time before 1914 thought this was the perfectly normal state of affairs. Now, of course, after World War I, after the war, most of the countries instituted passport controls and border controls from country to country. And Keynes in 1920 was lamenting the loss of this freedom that people used to enjoy in Europe. So that's part of the motivation for this paper. Another motivation is to try to draw a correlation or analogy between freedom of goods and freedom of people. You know, as economists, whether you're talking about Alfred Marshall, sort of standard neoclassical economists, or the Austrian economists, such as Mises or Rothbard, we all pride ourselves in being free traders. We all pride ourselves in being proud free traders. Lower tariffs, lower barriers to trade is good. It's theory of comparative advantage, whatever you want to call it. And yet, Richard Friedman is a professor at Harvard University, and I should mention he's not a classical liberal, but Richard Friedman has noticed in one of his papers in 2006 in the Journal of Economic Perspectives, he's, you know, what's really weird about this is that as we've talked about globalization, as we've talked about how important it is to lower trade barriers, no one talks about human barriers. You know, if you limit, as he suggests here, says, suggest linking standards to trade and its protection in disguise. Limit capital flows and the IMF is on your back. But restrict people? Well, that's just normal. That's an accepted exercise of natural sovereignty. So Richard Friedman was commenting in his paper in 2006 on, I really consider it the hypocrisy that we as economists argue for freedom of trade, freedom of capital, and yet we don't get all upset, we don't argue very much for freedom of people, the most fundamental capital of all is human beings. And so I think that where I see this paper and this long-run project that I'm engaged in going is trying to elevate the status of human beings in this debate about free trade. You know, it's really sad. I think it's horribly sad that it's actually easier for a crate of toys from China to move from China than it is for a Chinese citizen to come to the United States. I mean, we live in a really strange backward world where it's easier to move toys from country to country than it is for people to move from country to country. So anyway, that's the motivation for the paper. But we're going to start small. We're going to start at the very, very narrowest and in many ways the most trivial of all aspects. And that is simple tourist class travel. So I'm not talking today about traveling from country A to country B to work there or to immigrate. I'm talking about, I want to be a visitor. I want to visit another country. I want to stay 30 days or so in a country. And the question that I have is, do you require a visa for this? So it's a simple data collection exercise. Well, it sounds simple, but as you'll see in a minute, it's not all that simple. But it seems like a simple exercise. Does a visitor from a country require an entry visa to another country if they want to go there not to work, but simply for tourist travel purposes? It's a 0-1 piece of data. It's no if you don't need a visa, or if it's easily available on arrival. I'll talk about that in a minute. Or it's yes if you do need a visa. Now, in most cases, you don't need a visa at all. You can travel from the United States to, let's say, Mexico. Get on the plane, arrive in Mexico. If you're a U.S. passport holder, you do not need a special visa to travel to Mexico. You can get off the plane, walk right off the plane, show your passport, and off you go. You're on the beach an hour later. But in many countries, of course, you need to get a visa, which is more severe. It's a more difficult control than simply a passport. It is where you have to mail your passport in advance with some forms, typically some money, You oftentimes need to send photos. And so you have to send this into to some consulate or embassy in some other city, and it's quite difficult. So if you need to send your passport off with some money in a form and some photos to some foreign consulate in some strange city, then we code that as a yes, you need a visa. If you don't need to do that, then it's no, you don't need a visa. Now, there is an intermediate sort of case. Sometimes there is a visa requirement, but you can get it on arrival. So you get off the plane and you show your passport at one desk, and then the next desk you pay $20 and you have a visa. I just went to Turkey, for example. Turkey has a visa on arrival for U.S. citizens. If you're a U.S. citizen and you want to go to Turkey, you do need a visa. But the reality is you show up at the Istanbul airport, you pay them $20, they give you a visa, and it's really no more onerous or difficult than simply getting than simple passport control. So anyway, if you need a visa in advance, or if it's very, very difficult to acquire, it's a one. If you don't need a visa in advance, or if it's easy to get when you get there, it's a zero. And we've coded this for all the countries in the world. Again, I want to emphasize, we're not looking at long-term stays. We're not looking at people who want to stay for 6 months or 2 years to work, and we're certainly not looking at permanent immigrants. That's a much more difficult area of study, and we wanted to start this project at the simple level. Even at the simple level, this yes or no question is quite subjective, and so we had to make some choices. One example would be Kenya. Kenya, if you read the documentation, so for example, a U.S. citizen who wants to travel to Kenya, in theory, you can, you know, book a flight to Nairobi and show up at the Nairobi airport, and you can get a visa when you get there. The reality is very few people do that, and apparently it's pretty hard to do. So we've coded Kenya as a no, in the sense that it is not easy to get a Kenyan visa on arrival. It's possible, but it's going to take quite a bit of time and perhaps a bribe to get it. And then one other case that's quite difficult is Australia. Australia actually requires visas in advance, but it's really quite easy. But you have to do it in advance. So it's kind of a middle ground. Like an American citizen who wants to go to Australia, you have to go online, you have to pay them some money, but you don't have to send your passport in to the Australian consulate or anything like that. Now, it sounds like a real easy thing. Australia, you know, all you got to do if you want to go to Australia is to hop online, you give them your visa card number, and they charge your card, and they email you your visa. Sounds easy, right? Well, I was just in a conference, attending a conference in Sydney, and I met at least five or six people who screwed this up, who forgot about it, who, you know, whatever went wrong, and they had trouble in coming into Australia for the conference, and at least one or two people I heard about were actually turned away. So even Australia, which whose process looks simple, in fact, catches people all the time. And you know, I gotta tell a somewhat embarrassing personal story here as well. If you think that travel visas are not a big deal, oh, what's the big deal? You mail your passport off, a couple weeks later it comes back, you have a fancy stamp in it, it's all good. Well, you know, it's pretty easy for people that travel a lot to screw this up. A couple of years ago, I was supposed to be going to Brazil, to Rio, for a conference. Indeed, I had booked tickets for myself and for my wife. And literally, I should mention that this was after I had started this project. So here you have someone who's very interested in travel visas. Anyway, after I started this project, I had booked a flight to Rio. I had booked my wife a ticket to Rio. We were going to go together so I could attend this conference. And I forgot completely forgot to even consider the fact that Brazil requires a visa of U.S. citizens. So quite literally, the night before my trip, the very evening before, the plane leaves the next morning, I am due to get on a plane to Brazil. It dawns on me that, oh my God, do they have a visa? And sure enough, they do. And there's literally no way to get a visa to Brazil overnight. There's literally nobody can do it. It cannot be done. I was flying out of Atlanta, Georgia, There is actually a Brazilian consulate in Atlanta, but there is no way to get a visa on short-term notice. So the long story short is, here you have a world traveler like myself. I've been to some 40 countries. Someone who's actually something of a scholar on visas and visa requirements, and I myself screwed it up. I forgot about the Brazilian requirement, and the long story short is I had to go to my wife somewhat sheepishly and tell her, I'm sorry, honey, I know we're packed to go to Brazil in the morning, but we're not going to Brazil because I screwed up the visa. So this is a concern. I don't know how many people on the planet get caught up in it, but it's not something that doesn't matter. So that's what we're doing on the data collection. Let's take a look at the data itself. In terms of collecting the data, we're trying to collect data on whether countries require visas of other countries for simple travel purposes. The best data source by far is the International Air Transport Association. It's the IATA. This is actually a trade group that's funded by the airlines, and it's a private organization funded by the airlines, and their job is to create a current, up-to-date, an ongoingly current database of visa requirements for travel purposes. And the reason that airlines care about this, of course, is because if you show up on the plane at the airport and you want to fly to Brazil, if you don't have the proper paperwork to enter Brazil, it's up to the airline to fly you back home. So the airline has an incentive to monitor visa requirements. So the IATA is the private trade group for the airlines that keeps a great database on visa requirements for different countries. It is the best source, but access is quite limited. I mean, if you're an airline, you have unlimited access to the database, but as a private person myself, a private researcher, I only have very limited access to the database. You can type in, like, I'm a U.S. citizen, I want to travel to Brazil, and click enter, and it'll tell you what the visa requirement is, but it takes, you know, 30 seconds for it to work, and when you get right down to it, it's a very cumbersome interface for a private person to use. The second source, though, which is not as good as the IATA source, though, but it's more easy to use, is the U.S. State Department. The U.S. State Department has links on their website to foreign embassies and consulates, and those foreign embassies and consulates typically have information about visa requirements for any of those countries. The third source is something called projectvisa.com. You can certainly go to that on your own time. Projectvisa.com is a private group. It's quite easy to use. It's almost like a Wikipedia thing. It's not really a Wikipedia thing, but it's a private group, and they try to collect visa information. It is easy to use. It's very simple. Unfortunately, from our point of view, it tends to be a little bit slow and out of date. It requires someone to update it, and that doesn't always happen in a timely fashion. So in any case, in terms of gathering the data, we try to use the best source we could. Typically, we would start with the U.S. State Department. If it had a good link to a foreign embassy or foreign consulate, we would grab the data there. If that wasn't there, or if we weren't sure, we would sometimes get it from the IATA. We use Project Visa as a backup. In the limit also, we also would sometimes Google or use Wikipedia. There were some information we could get from there. But I want to emphasize how quite massive this project is. You know, we actually have data in this paper and in this project for 188 countries. So there's 188 countries in the index. Well, what that means in this study, that means there's 187 other countries. So if you multiply 188 times 187, you have 35,156 country pairs. So every Brazil, you know, if you think about it, Brazil has a visa policy with every country in the world. Every country in the world has a policy with visa. The U.S. has a policy with every country in the world. Every country in the world has a policy with the United States. And so we have a huge matrix of countries, 188 by 188 country matrix of visa requirements. In terms of what the final sort of data set looks like, this is just a small portion of it. Again, it's 188 by 188 matrix. And the question again is, do you require a tourist visa for a stay of 30 days or so? And it's again, no, it means it's a zero. So if you don't require a visa, or if you require a visa but it's easy to get on arrival, it's a zero. Or if you do need a visa, it's yes. Or if it's difficult to arrive to obtain on arrival, it's a one. So you can see all of these countries with ones. That indicates that this country in the column here requires a visa of the countries, or this country in this column requires all a visa of these countries over here. So for example, Andorra. Andorra requires a visa of anyone coming into Andorra who's a citizen of Afghanistan, Albania, Algeria. There's nothing here because it's Andorra versus Andorra. But Andorra requires visas of everybody from all these countries. But if you're from Austria, you can come into Andorra without a visa. So the ones indicate that that this country over here requires a visa of this country over here. A zero indicates that you don't. So you hear the weird one, really, Antigua and Barbuda in the Caribbean. It requires a visa of people from Afghanistan, people of Algeria, people of Andorra, but doesn't require one of people from Albania, of all places. So there you go. So you can see, you know, who requires a visa of whom. So this is how the data set looks like. But again, there's 188 countries in the data set. So there's 188 countries this way, 188 this way. The diagonal, the Afghanistan, Albania, this is the diagonal of empty cells. So again, there's 35,156 zeros and ones. And, you know, it's not symmetric. Antigua and Barbuda does not require a visa of Albanian citizens, but Albania does require a visa of Antigua Barbuda citizens. So each one of these cells is quite unique, and it has to be put in essentially by hand. So even if it only takes a few seconds per cell, this was quite a monumental data collection exercise for us. And by us, I mean Jamie, because Jamie did most of the work, let's be honest. So anyway, this is what the data set looks like. And the data set is available. It's posted online on a Google Doc that's shared with the public. So if you want to look at the data set, you're welcome to grab that. All right, so there's really two perspectives. So the first, once we had collected the data set, there were two sort of points of view that we thought you could think about this. One was, how easy is it for a foreigner to travel into a country? And we have an index called an EOTF. And so it's in this sense that this paper today fits with the overall theme of the course, the Economic Freedom Index. We have an index here of the ease of travel of foreigners, EOTF. And it reflects the visa policy of a particular nation towards citizens of other countries. So for the United States, for example, this index would be, what percentage of the rest of the world needs a visa to come into the United States? And this is the visa that is relevant from a policy point of view. This is the point of view that you know, the United States Congress controls this. The United States Congress controls how many people in other countries how many other countries require visas to come into the United States. So the EOTF is a measure of how difficult it is for foreigners to come into a particular country. But the flip side of that coin is to look at how easy is it, or how hard is it, to leave a country, to travel abroad. And this is the EOTA, the Ease of Travel Abroad Index, and it reflects the visa policy of the rest of the world with respect to countries of a particular nation. So from a U.S. point of view, this would be what percentage of the rest of the world requires a visa for us to travel abroad. And this is the relevant point of view for an individual person. So if you're a member of Congress, the EOTF is something you care about. This is something that as a member of Congress, or at least as Congress collectively, you can control. You can determine, Congress can determine what percentage of the rest of the world can travel into the United States. As an American citizen, as an individual citizen, though, perhaps the EOTA is what matters, because this is how many countries in the rest of the world can you travel to without requiring a visa. And that's sort of what I care about as an American citizen. So we can measure with the database, with this big database we have previously, we can measure the ease of travel both in an inward sense, foreigners coming in, but we can also measure it in an outward sense, U.S. citizens leaving to other countries. And so we have we have an index. And so that's why this is part of this lecture series, because this lecture series is about freedom indexes. This is I consider this to be a travel freedom index. And we have a couple different versions. One is we've got the ease of travel for foreign visitors. How easy is it for foreign travelers to come into the country, and EOTF. Now we have this both as the raw score, the EOTF that you see here, that's the percentage of countries. So, for example, Afghanistan. Afghanistan actually requires visas of everybody who wants to enter Afghanistan. If you want to come to Afghanistan, you must have a visa in advance from an Afghanistan embassy or consulate. If you want to come into Albania, you actually have to have a visa, apparently, as well, to travel into Albania. So this EOTF is the share of the rest of the world, the share of the countries around the world that require a visa to enter into this particular country. And it's measured as zero means everybody requires a visa. It's hard to know. And the higher the number means the easier it is. So for the United States, for example, the United States, the value is 19.79. What that means is that the U.S. requires visas of about 80% of the world. Only about 20% of the world, countries in the world, can enter the United States without a visa. We also do this in a population-weighted sense, so, because this is just based by country. So this is 19 or 20% of the countries in the world. This is people in the world. So we weighted by population. So it's worse with that. So the United States, only about 10% of the entire planet in the world can enter the United States without a visa. Just for travel, not for working, just to come in and see go to Disneyland. Only 10% of the world or so people in the world can come to the United States without a visa. And I should mention that it's quite a serious deal. A Brazilian citizen, for example, who wants to come to the United States to go to Disneyland, just to visit, has to submit their application 6 months in advance, and they have to have a personal interview with a U.S. citizen, a U.S. consulate officer. So this is really a serious concern. Okay, so that's the EOTF. I do it both unweighted, and we do a population weight. Over on the right, we have an index which measures the ease of travel for citizens going abroad. So we have the ease EOTA unweighted, and then we have it also populated, population weighted. So if you look at the EOTA for the United States, then for the United States, we can go to a lot of countries. 57% of the countries in the world allow U.S. citizens to enter those countries without a visa. Now, I should mention that it's not so good in terms of population weighted, because several of the countries that are large, like Brazil, India, Russia, the largest countries in the world, Indonesia, they do, in fact, require visas. So it's not so good in a population weighted sense, but if you pick a random country in the world, a U.S. citizen has about a 60% chance of being able to travel to that country without requiring a visa. So you can see other countries, it's not so good. So, Afghanistan requires visas of everybody coming into Afghanistan, and most places require visas of Afghanis who want to come into those countries. Only 4% of the countries in the world or so allow Afghanis to come into Afghanistan or come into their country without a visa. Okay. So again, you have to imagine that there's a table, and there's a table in the paper that's 188 long. We have these data on ease of coming of foreigners coming in and ease of citizens leaving. We have data for 188 countries. We have both population weighted and also unweighted. There are other ways to slice and dice the data. We also have a table in the paper which looks at country pairs. So let's take a look at the United States. It's easiest. So we have four columns here. Think about this. If you pair up every country in the world, there's basically four possibilities. One possibility is that both countries require a visa of each other. And so for the United States, if you pair the United States against every other country in the world, there's 187 other countries that we pair up with the United States. 41% of those countries require a visa. and the United States requires a visa of them. A country in which this country, which neither requires a visa, is 19.15. This is a situation in which neither the United States nor the other country requires a visa for travel. This would be like Brazil, or not Brazil, this would be like Mexico or Canada. And then there's the third pair is where this country requires a visa, but the other doesn't. So this is where the United States requires a visa of the incoming foreigner, but the foreign country, the same foreign country, does not require a visa of U.S. citizens. So you see 38% there. And then finally, we have the situation where this country does not require a visa, but the other country does. So the U.S., very few countries in the world, only a couple countries in the world exist where we don't require a visa of them, but their country requires a visa of ours. So this is sort of another way to slice and dice the data. And again, there's 188 countries in the world. We have it parsed out in sort of all four possibilities when we look at country pairs. This is just some correlation coefficients between the EOTF and the EOTA, whether it's population weighted. It's from the paper, but it's really not all that important. I'm going to skip this. Now, one of the things we did in the paper is we just looked at some raw averages by area and such. And so you can look at the EOTF, the ease of travel for foreigners coming into a country, or the EOTA, ease of travel for foreigners or for people leaving. You can do it for everywhere in the world, or you can do it by region, use North America, Caribbean, and so forth. And I don't have a lot to say about it, but this was just some of the descriptive statistics that we wanted to put in the paper. This is the same kind of thing also done by legal origin. And there are some interesting patterns here. If you look, for example, at Scandinavian countries are quite relatively good towards foreigners. 31% of the rest of the world can travel into Scandinavian countries on average. And Scandinavians themselves are treated quite favorably. Almost 60% of them can travel abroad. So there's some pretty good patterns in terms of legal origin countries. So once we had this data set, and once we had this ease of travel or this ease of human mobility index, we wanted to look at sort of other measures of openness. And there are a lot of measures of openness to the outside world or globalization. And we want to look at those. So we have measures of tariffs, non-tariff barriers, the size of trade itself, and exchange rate controls. These are actually all from the Economic Freedom Index. We have measures of international capital controls. We also index of trade openness overall, and an index of something called the KOF Globalization Index. I don't know why there's an empty space there. Actually, this, tariffs, non-tariff barriers, size of trade sector, exchange rate controls, international capital controls, and overall trade openness. All of these first six components, these are all coming from the Economic Freedom of the World Index. And the last one is from something called the KOF Globalization Index. But basically, they're all measures of different types of openness. Openness to the outside world. And we wanted to look if whether you're open to goods, or whether you're open to capital, or whether you're just generally open to globalization. If you're open in these dimensions over here, if that correlated at all with being open to people. And it turns out all, except for one little one, which is very small, that's negative, essentially everything is positive here. If you look at the last one especially, it's quite positive. So I like to look at this one. It turns out that if you look at our ease of travel, whether you look at the ease of travel of foreigners coming into a country or ease of travel of people leaving a country, it turns out there's a pretty strong correlation between this globalization index put out by this group called it's KOF. I forget what that stands for. Forgive me. We can all Google it. It's an index of globalization. It's pretty good correlation. 0.43. It's out of, again, correlation coefficients always are bounded between 0 and 1. So 0.8 is really high. What this says here, right here, is that countries that are treated very well are also very globalized. And even this 0.43 is not a very low. That's a pretty good correlation. That says countries who treat foreigners well are also pretty globalized. So there does seem to be some correlation between measures of openness, measures of openness to goods, measures of openness to capital, and just general measures of globalization. There is some measure. There's some correlation between these measures and this sort of human openness to human travel. And so that's what this table is all about. We actually have a couple graphs with the KOF globalization index. You can sort of see this. This is the EOTF. I don't have these axis marked, sorry, but on the horizontal axis is the this is the ease of travel for foreigners. It's on a 0 to 100 scale. The globalization index, the KOF globalization index, is also on 0 to 100 scale. And you can see there's a nice correlation here. You might know these bars here. There are a lot of countries that are zeros, like Afghanistan. There's a zero in the EOTF, remember? So you get a lot of zeros. And then over here, this is actually the Shenzhen group. This is Europe, basically. All of the European countries have harmonized. Most of the European countries, anyway, have harmonized their visa regime. So this is where Europe actually falls. That's why you see those sort of bars, or those bands there. Over here on this one, we see the EOTA. This is the ease of travel of citizens abroad on the horizontal axis. The vertical axis, again, is the globalization index. And actually, that's a bit of a stronger positive relationship. So if nothing else, one of the things that we think this paper creates is an argument that the looking at the ease of travel from people abroad or people into countries is, in fact, one more dimension of globalization. All right. So the last part of the paper is a statistical analysis. We wanted to look at why countries require visas of other countries. And this is a dyad analysis. A dyad is simply means country pair. So you have 188 countries, and there's 187 other countries. So there's 35,156 country pairs. And each one of those countries has a visa policy with respect to the other country. So on the left-hand side, we have the visa policy of country I with respect to country J. So it might be the visa of the United States with respect to Brazil, or the visa policy of the United States with respect to Mexico. With respect to Brazil, it's a 1. With respect to Mexico, it's a 0. So we're measuring on the left-hand side whether or not a given country I requires a visa of a given country J. And then what we were interested in is in terms of trying to figure out why do different countries require visas of other countries? We wanted on the right-hand side to include some characteristics of the I countries. So what is it about countries that impose the visa that might let them impose the visa? So there are M characteristics for countries I, and then there are M characteristics for country J. So we're looking at what are the characteristics of the visa policy country, and what are the characteristics of the other country? So country I is going to impose a visa on country J. So what we're trying to do is explain that decision based on the characteristics of country I and also the characteristics of country J, and also if those characteristics are shared, if they're common characteristics. That's just an error term. It's not important over here. So let me just sort of go to the data. And this looks way more complicated, perhaps, than it is. And it's really not that complicated. First of all, we have 35,000 data points in the raw data set, but because of missing values for the explanatory variables, we only had 14,519 observations. So there's 14,519 country pairs in this analysis. And again, the left-hand side or the independent variable is whether or not country I requires a visa of country J. So let's take a look at some of the results. They really make sense. So if country I is big in income, if it's a big country, then that's a negative sign right there. And that means that since this is 1 if you don't require a visa, or if you do require a visa, and 0 if you don't, large countries, the larger the country, the lower the number. So the larger the country is, the less likely you are to, the more likely you are to have a visa. Countries that are, let me just sort of summarize the results over here. Countries that are large tend to have more visas with respect to foreigners. And countries that are large tend to have I'm being confused here. Countries that are rich have high GDPs. Richer countries mean fewer visas. Negative signs here mean fewer visas. So rich countries are more liberal. Rich countries, whether country I is rich or country J is rich, they both tend, that tends to mean you're less likely to have a visa between I and J. With respect to large, in terms of population, in terms of size, we're all size, not richness, but size, large countries are likely to impose visas on other countries. If you think about it, what are the countries that impose visas on other countries? It's the United States, it's Russia, it's Brazil, it's India, it's China. Countries that are large in population tend to impose visas much more visas on foreigners. The flip side, though, is if you're a large country, you have a large population yourself, the rest of the world is not likely to impose a visa on you. So the United States is a classic example. And the United States requires a visa. We're a large country, and we require visas of lots of people coming into the United States. But U.S. citizens themselves, in fact, are treated quite nicely. We are allowed to, people are allowed to, U.S. citizens are allowed to go abroad much more freely than foreigners are allowed to come into the United States. And so we're picking that up here. That sign is positive, indicating that that the U.S., which is country I here, the U.S. imposes big restrictions on people coming in, but other countries don't impose restrictions on us. Economic freedom. We included the economic freedom of both I and J, whether country I has got economic freedom, is liberal in general, and country J is liberal in general. Again, negative signs, meaning economic freedom means fewer visas. If you're a socialist legal origin, you have more visas. If you're a German legal origin, you have more visas. The other thing that's kind of cool about these results is that if you have similar, if the two countries are both rich, negative sign, meaning if you're similar, if both countries are rich, it's less likely that country I has a visa on country J. If both countries are big, or if both countries are small, if they have very similar populations, it's less likely they have visas. If both countries have the same economic freedom or similar economic freedom, it's less likely they have things. So one of the things that we're seeing is that when countries have the same geographic origin, same legal origin, same economic or similar economic freedom, similar population, similar GDPs, the more similar countries are, the less likely they are to have visas on each other. So these are just some statistical results trying to figure out what the pattern is. Why do some countries require visas on others? And for the most part, the results make sense. Countries that are richer tend not to impose visas. Countries that are big tend to impose visas, but they tend not to have visas imposed upon them. Economic free countries tend to have fewer visas. Socialist countries, or at least socialist legal origin and German legal origin countries have more. And if any two countries are very similar, they tend to have fewer visas. So that's pretty much the paper. It's a very simple paper. You have to be able to realize it took us a year to collect these data. It's a lot of data collection. And the analysis at this point is pretty simple. All we really have at this point is, let me go back. All we really have at this point is raw data. We've collected some data. We've done a little preliminary analysis here about why some countries have visas on other countries and why others don't. We haven't gone beyond that. And in the future, what I want to do is I want to look at whether or not it matters. If the United States has a visa against Brazilian citizens, does that matter? Does that mean Brazilian citizens don't travel to the United States as frequently? In fact, I believe that's the case. I think Brazilian citizens are much more likely to travel to France and Spain because they can go to France and Spain without a visa. And to come to the United States is really quite an onerous process. So one of the things I'm going to do next as we pursue this project is look at whether or not travel patterns, country people moving, traveling from country to country, if those patterns are impacted at all by the requirement to have a visa. We want to look at other things, whether or not travel visas impact on trade and trade flows and things like that. So there's a lot of research that we're going to do. The first step is to look at is just to collect the data and do some preliminary analysis, and that's what we have here. Before I conclude and we open it up to if there's any questions, I do want to sort of put up a picture here. You know, I realize that there's some dispute about this among Austrians, and I understand that Hans Hoppe has a somewhat different view, but I really do think that as classical liberals, we really do have we're honor bound to pay more attention to the freedom of people to move from place to place peacefully. I think we're all, I'm not a very religious person, but we're all God's creatures. And the fact that somebody had the misfortune to draw to be born on the wrong side of a line that some politician drew on a map is really unfortunate. And that it shouldn't matter too much, at least in my worldview. It shouldn't matter that somebody was born on the south side of the Rio Grande River versus the north side of the Rio Grande River. We're all human beings. We all have the same rights. And unfortunately, these national borders really do matter in the lives of a lot of people. And travel visas are just a tiny, 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 and maybe almost insignificant part of that story. So the motivation, though, for me becoming interested in travel visas was because I really do think that we should be paying more attention. And the pictures like the one you see here, this, of course, is quite an extreme picture. This is the Warsaw ghetto in Warsaw, Poland. This is the Jewish ghetto in Poland. And of course, the German officers asking for someone's papers. I think it's really a horrible situation we live in, a world where you want to cross a line that some policies draw on a map, and you have to give some government official your papers. So I think this is part of it's an academic project, but it's part of what I think a larger classical liberal project. And I hope that generated some interest in you all. So I'm concluding with my part. And if there's any questions, I'm happy to take them. This is our last lecture. If there's any questions about any other lectures, I'm happy to take those as well. I'm going to leave it open to you all. I only see one thing on the chat here. Daniel says something about security. You know, that in fact is the argument for visas. The argument for travel visas is that it's about security. But, you know, I got to be honest. If you look at the pattern, it's bizarre. I mean, we require visas of countries. There has literally never been, at least to my knowledge, a Brazilian citizen come to the United States, to do a terrorist act, and yet we require visas of Brazilians. So visas, are separate from passports. Visa requirements, advanced checking of citizens by country, are really a very blunt instrument. And I should mention that every one of the countries, if you think about 9/11, every one of the terrorists who were involved in the 9/11 terrorist attacks, every one of those people was from a country that in fact had a visa requirement. So if you think visa requirements are necessary for security purposes, it's clearly a very blunt instrument. We require visas of countries where we've never had a terrorist come, and the countries where we do have visas hasn't apparently stopped them from coming. So I think that's a bit of a red herring. I understand that other people have that argument. But. Yeah, Matthew, I appreciate your point. That Hoppe's view is that society based on private property, that going from place A to place B is really always about moving from one person's property to another person's property, and government shouldn't be involved. And to that extent, I suppose I agree. I suppose that, the bottom line is we don't live in that freaking world. We just don't live in a world where every piece of property is private. We have common law at least in English countries, English common law countries. We have easements, and we have all kinds of law that allow people to move from place to place, even if it is private property. And those things, I think, make a lot of sense. And the other thing is we live in a world where we have national borders. So the imaginary world that Hoppe lives in, where every plot of the planet Earth is owned by a private person. In that world, I suppose I would agree, but that's not the world we live in. In the world we live in, we have airports, and I can I can drive to the Dallas-Fort Worth airport, and in the process of doing so, I never trespass on anyone's property. I can get on an airplane, I can land tomorrow morning in Rio de Janeiro, and in the process, never trespass anyone's property. And I still need a visa. There's still a government check. So I think that's, in the real world we live in, the imperfect real world we live in, that's what I'm interested in. Alicia, do all countries let their citizens leave their country of citizen? Well, clearly not. I mean, Cuba clearly does not do that. North Korea clearly does not do that. But most countries do. Very few countries have any kind of exit control. But obviously, there are some. Okay, Mark, Daniel, your question, I'm not sure how to respond to that. Mark, you asked a question about immigration, and some people would argue that allowing immigration allows, from countries like Mexico or any other country, I suppose, it allows us to import leftists. Maybe. I mean, we live in a world where we have a democracy, and that democracy can choose leftist policies. I guess, you know, I understand the other point of view that maybe we should keep out foreigners because those foreigners will come here and they'll vote for leftists. But I look at human mobility as such a fundamental value. I just don't agree with restricting immigration for that reason. I just don't. I understand the argument. It's an argument that's been advanced by, you know, people like Robert Rector at the Heritage Foundation. If immigrants coming to the United States vote leftists, well, that's our problem. That's our fault for having a stupid democracy that lets it happen. I mean, I just don't think it makes a lot of sense. You know, and the other thing, let me play devil's advocate. If you think that we should use the apparatus of the state to prevent Mexicans from coming to the United States because they might vote leftist, then I suppose you should also support using the apparatus of the state to expel Americans who vote leftist. And I don't know many people who believe that should be done. We have a democracy, for better or worse, frequently for worse. I'm not going to violate the fundamental right of a human being to move from place A to place B because of some risk they might vote the wrong way. Doing so in opens a can of worms that I think is really worse than the original problem. I mean, seriously, if you think keeping Mexicans out so they might vote the wrong way, then you should also support kicking Americans out and vote the wrong way. That's a worldview that I don't think most people are going to be comfortable with. Matthew, excellent question. There is some work on mobility and immigration. One of the problems, of course, is that mobility from an immigration standpoint is highly restricted. So it's, but there is evidence from a fellow named Nathan Ashby. I'll write his name down. Nathan Ashby, who is at UTEP, University of Texas, El Paso. He is an expert on immigration flows, and he has looked at mobility from and economic freedom. It's kind of cool. He, for example, he has a paper for the United States where he shows that states of the United States that have more economic freedom are attracting immigrants from states that have less economic freedom. He has another paper where he looks at Mexican states and U.S. states. Really cool because he compares. Immigrant flows from Mexican states to U.S. states, and what he finds is that people in Mexican states are immigrating into the United States, they're going to economically free states. So Nathan Ashby is the sort of go-to guy on everything about economic freedom and immigration patterns, and what he is showing basically is that, yes, people are attracted to economic freedom. Economic freedom attracts people, and the lack of economic freedom repels people. There are patterns in the data. Immigration data, people leaving countries with less economic freedom and going, and countries and states with less economic freedom and going to countries with more, or states with more. He's a very young scholar. He's a kid. He's like in his 20s, but he's doing some really neat work. And the new paper he has on Mexican immigration from Mexican states to U.S. states I think is one of the coolest papers I've ever read. Yeah, as usual, most of you are not talking about this paper. This paper is about travel visas, and everybody wants to talk immigration. So, I understand that argument, and that's a much deeper argument. But. Daniel, you asked, I thought we only let immigrants who work more efficiently than average. I'm not really sure what you mean. The general evidence on immigrants in the United States is that it's very bimodal. We let in very highly skilled immigrants, like doctors and engineers, and we also let in very low skilled immigrants, mostly illegals, but we still potentially let them in. So the distribution of skills among immigrants is very bimodal. It's a lot of low skilled workers and also a lot of very, very high skilled workers. There's not much of a middle ground. I'm sorry, Mark, I've never really encountered that argument about immigration and the minimum wage. One of the reasons immigrants come to the United States is especially illegals, is they can come to the United States and they're willing to work for sub-minimum wage. And Americans, who at least those who obey the law, are subject to it, and some of them find difficulty finding work. My answer is, if you're an American who can't work for minimum wage, whose skills are such that you don't work for minimum wage, then you should just cheat too, like the illegals, and get a job. I'm not being completely a joke here. I mean, I personally worked myself in my younger days at some minimum wage illegally. So my advice to Americans who can't get jobs because of minimum wage is to go get a job illegally. They have a right to get a job, and if it breaks the law, that's not crime in my opinion. Mark, you had actually above, you're asking, I think it's the most fundamental question about immigration. Shouldn't political units that will bear the upfront costs of immigrants be the ones who decide the costs, decide who comes? That's certainly the normal view. But you know, if our political system is created, again, this is similar to my other answer, if our political system has created an environment where immigrants can come to the United States and they can impose costs on us, if immigrants come to the United States, for example, and their children go to our public schools and that costs us money, or some people get sick and that costs us money at the hospitals. You know what, I'll be blunt. That's our own damn fault for having a stupid political system. I just don't think we should be blaming immigrants for our dumb welfare state. We have a dumb welfare state that lets people free ride. And if some immigrants come to the United States and they free ride too, I don't see why they're any, why I should feel worse about that than Americans who free ride. So again, it goes back to the original question. I don't think that because we have a welfare state that gives benefits to people, that gives us the right to stop a human being from crossing a border that some politician drew on a map. That's my own view, and I really do appreciate that it's a minority view, and many, many, many people, especially people in the Republican Party. Policies of reciprocity, countries most countries claim that if you require a visa of us, we will require a visa of you, but if you drop your visa, we will drop our visa. There is tit for tat, and there is some evidence of that, but there are a lot of mismatches. The United States is the worst example. We are the worst example of a country. We require visas of most of the rest of the world. 80% of the rest of the world has to get a visa to come to the United States. But some 60% of our citizens, but we're allowed to go to some 60% of the rest of the world without a visa. So there's a big disconnect in the tit for tat or reciprocity with the United States. But there have been, there are visa wars out there. When you talk about trade wars, you know, where you think about countries imposing tariffs and other countries responding with tariffs, there are visa wars out there. The United States and Brazil are in a visa war. Bolivia and the United States are in a visa war. Bolivia used to not require a visa of U.S. citizens going to Bolivia, but the U.S. did. And Bolivia got mad, and they very, very pompously and politically imposed a visa on U.S. citizens going to Bolivia because they were penalizing the U.S. So there are minor visa wars out there, just like we have trade wars. I mean, they don't get the headlines that, that trade wars get because they're probably not as important, frankly, but they do exist. Is there another country I would consider immigrating to permanently? Mark, that's a wonderful question. And I suppose you have to ask it. There's two dimensions. One is, do you mean for living or for work? I mean, one of the problems is that traveling, emigrating to another country for work purposes is highly restricted. It's very hard to travel to a lot of places for work purposes. And I've got to be honest, from my personal point of view, there are very few places in the world that have job markets that are as attractive as the U.S. job market. But from a living point of view, hell yeah, I plan to retire outside the United States. There are many, many countries, and you know, I have some wealth, so I'll be able to afford to live in a foreign country well and safely, and with lower taxes and fewer regulations. And I plan to my retirement program includes moving abroad. I haven't decided where yet. I do speak a little Spanish, so Costa Rica is a possibility, but South Africa is a possibility. I've even talked about living with my wife in the Republic of Georgia because I go to Georgia all the time. So I don't speak Georgian, though, so it might be hard. Mark, excellent question. Whether or not utilitarian or consequentialist arguments or rights-based arguments work better. On this particular question, I really do think the rights-based argument works more, which is ironic because I mean most of this paper and most of my work is consequentialist in nature. I do think that a rights-based argument has more power. That line that I use about a human being traveling across a line that some politician drew on a map, that has resonance with a lot of people. The idea that we're all God's creatures, that has resonance. So the debate about immigration or even just travel in general, I think that it's one of the few debates where the rights-based argument has considerable power. That's not to say that data-based or consequentialist-based arguments have no power. But I do think the rights-based argument works here. I don't think the rights-based argument works in a lot of other areas, but I do think it works relatively well here. Steve, no, that's a great question. I understand that the length of time that you have remaining on your visa is an issue in a lot of countries. That's something that is way, way too difficult for us to consider. I thought about that, but I know people have gotten screwed on that. I know people that have ended up in a country and they had, you know, too few months left on their visa or their passport, and they got sent home, or they had all kinds of hassles. But no, that's not something we've been able to consider. Daniel, good question. Also, two questions really. Should immigrants in a world without borders be able to run for office or for president? Honestly, I don't give a darn. I really don't care. Yeah, I suppose the answer is probably no, but if the answer was yes, I don't think we'd get much worse than what we get right now. So honestly, I don't care. If every illegal immigrant in the world voted in the next election, I don't think we'd get much worse results than we're going to get. The second question, though, I do believe I've got an answer to. I do not believe an open border policy would have any security effect. I do not believe if we completely dropped passport controls and visas, we would have much less security than we have right now. Again, literally every one of those terrorists who blew up the buildings, every one of those countries came from a country for which we had severe visa requirements, and that did not stop them from coming in and blowing up those buildings. So, I don't think it's going to do that. I don't know if everyone knows Rehavis or not. So. Yeah, Mark, I do think nationalism is a problem. I think the classical, I don't think it's necessary to be a cosmopolitan, to be a classical liberal, but I really do think it helps. I do think there's something fundamental about the classical liberal worldview that lends one towards a cosmopolitan view of the world that doesn't see any significance in borders and that we're all God's creatures. In that a nationalist worldview, a worldview that says that some people on one line of the map, on one side of the line of the map, are different than others, I think it's harder to be a classical liberal. That doesn't mean you can't be. I mean, I know people who are classical liberals domestically. They're libertarians in every sense of that word, who are nationalists. But I do think there is a strong correlation in terms of broad worldview between cosmopolitanism and classical liberalism. I think if you look at the iconic classical liberals, Mises and Rothbard and Hayek and Friedman, these people were not nationalists at all, and I think there's a reason for that. I think it has to do more with worldview, though. I mean, we just don't see significance in these lines that politicians draw on maps. Mark, the labels are hard. I do consider myself an anarcho-libertarian, I suppose. Whether or not I'm an Austrian is a difficult question. I'm not a trained Austrian. I did not attend a college. I did not go to George Mason University, and I have not read the Austrian canon in detail. I've read Human Action, but only casually. I've read Man, Economy, and State, but again, only casually. I have not studied these texts like I think many Austrian economists have. If I compare myself to Austrian economists like Peter Fedke or Walter Block, then I feel inadequate in my understanding of Austrian economics. Having said that, one of my best friends is Benjamin Powell. Benjamin Powell is at Suffolk University. Some of you may know him. Ben and I are close friends, and we're also hiking buddies. So we hike mountains together. We'll be in the mountains sometimes for days and days on end. And, you know, when you're with the same person for 24 hours a day for a week, we talk a lot. And Ben asks me questions, and he's convinced I'm an Austrian economist. So I'm uncomfortable calling myself an Austrian economist because I don't feel like I've studied Austrian economics like Austrian economists have. But Ben, who is a trained Austrian economist, says, "Man, you're every bit as Austrian as I am. It's just, you know, I just don't know how to label myself that. You know, I'm a hardcore believer in subjective value. I'm a hardcore believer in I think the Hayekian knowledge problem is the fundamental problem. The socialist calculation problem is the fundamental problem. So, in many practical ways, I'm an Austrian. I just haven't studied the texts as carefully as a lot of other people. So that's. If I notice any increasing shift towards libertarian among students, not really. you know, it's hard to judge because if you're a libertarian professor on a college campus, you tend to students tend to self-select to you. So libertarian-minded students tend to find me. They seek me out. And so I've always found a lot of libertarian students around me. But it's hard for me to say because I don't really think about a general sample. And to be honest, when I teach a regular class in economics, and I don't talk too much about politics, and I don't really get a good sense of what my students' politics are. So I don't know if they're a minority or majority or what. But when students come to my office, I tend to over-select the libertarian students. Mark, absolutely. Mark Kravac, good question again. Absolutely. We talked about TiVo competition is voting with your feet, the importance of letting people move from place to place, letting goods move from place to place, letting capital move from place to place in terms of getting good governance. Absolutely, open borders would facilitate that. And I do think, and that's why I'm suspicious of the argument that letting Mexicans come in the United States would be, because all the leftists is a problem. I think that if you're open, you're going to attract liberty-minded people. If you're closed, you're going to keep them out. So I'm pretty open to the idea that TiVo competition works. I think in the United States it worked quite well, at least. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't work internationally. Well, folks, I'm going to close up here in a few minutes. I got a thing I got to get to. We had an event on campus. There's another event I've got to get to. It's late, but if there's any more questions, I can take them. I hope you all have enjoyed the series of lectures. I've enjoyed doing it a little bit more than I thought I would, actually, so it's been kind of fun. If any of you are doing the quiz or for grade, I gave Danny Sanchez a small quiz that will basically be your grade. We'll grade that. I hope you all do well if you're doing it for a grade. If you have any questions or any questions about this lecture, the other lectures, any papers, please do it. I'm a huge fan of seasteading. I didn't see that question. Sorry. Huge fan of seasteading. I don't know if it's going to work, but I love it. I want to. My 16-year-old daughter, wants to move to a seastead. She's crazy. So, absolutely. Seasteading, Alicia, it's great. It's actually go to the Seasteading Institute. I don't know if it's going to work, but I hope it will work. It's actually a program being promoted by David Friedman's son, Milton Friedman's grandson. So it's good pedigree there. So there is interest in doing a floating country, and that country would be exempt from national policies, taxes, and regulations. It would be run like a business, though. There would still be regulations and some fees and such, but it would be more market-oriented. I think it'd be great to go this way. Who knows what it would do on visas, but it'd be really cool. Big fan. My daughter is 16, like I said, and like every idealistic 16-year-old, she's ready to move off and live in the ocean. God bless her. All right, everybody, thank you very much. Again, I hope you all enjoyed it, and please do contact me if you have any more questions. It's been a lot of fun.